His shoulders ached a little from his efforts, but not badly. He worried that he'd overloaded the cart. Its wheels were stronger than his mag boots, but they could still be overcome. The asteroid above him lurched once, a new and unsettling motion that didn't repeat. His hand terminal cut off the Eros feed, alerting him that he had an incoming connection. He looked at it, shrugged, and let the call come through. "Naomi," he said before she could speak. "Have you been doing?"
"Hey," she said.
The silence between them stretched.
"You talked to Holden, then?"
"I did," she said. "He's still talking about ways of getting you off that thing."
"He's a good guy," Miller said. "Talk him out of it for me, okay?"
The silence hung long enough that Miller started to get uncomfortable. "What are you doing there?" she asked, as if there were an answer for that, as if all his life could be summarized in answer to one simple question. He danced around what she meant and replied only to what she'd said.
"Well, I've got a nuclear bomb strapped to a cargo wagon. I'm hauling it over to the access hatch and taking it into the station."
"Miller,
the thing is, we're treating this like a rock. Now everyone knows that's a little simplistic, but it's going to take people time to adjust. Navies are still going to be thinking of this thing like a billiard ball when it's really a rat."
He was talking too fast, the words spilling out of him in a rush. If he didn't give her room, she wouldn't talk. He wouldn't have to hear what she had to say. He wouldn't have to keep her from talking him down.
"It's going to have structure. Engines or control centers, something. If I truck this thing inside, get it close to whatever coordinates the thing, I can break it. Turn it back into a billiard ball. Even if it's just for a little while, that gives the rest of you a chance."
"I figured," she said. "It makes sense. It's the right thing to do."
Miller chuckled.
A particularly solid impact talked against the ship beneath him, the vibration of it jarring his bones. Gas started venting out of the new hole. The station was moving faster.
"Yeah," he said. "Well..."
"I was talking to Amos," she said. "You need a dead man switch, so that if something happens, the bomb still goes off. If you have the access codes..."
"I do."
"Good. I've got a routine you can put on your hand terminal. You'll need to keep your finger on the select button. If you go away for 5 seconds, it sends the go signal. If you want, I can upload it to you."
"So I have to wander around the station with my finger mashed on a button?"
Naomi's tone made it an apology. "They might take you out with a headshot, or wrestle you down. The longer the gap, the more chance for the protomolecule to disable the bomb before it goes off. If you need more, I can reprogram it." Miller looked at the bomb resting on its cart just outside the ship's airlock. Its readouts all glowed green and gold. His sigh briefly fogged the inside of his helmet.
"Yeah, no, 5 is good. Upload the routine. Am I going to need to tweak it, or is there a simple place I can put the arm and fire string?"
"There's a setup section," Naomi said. "It prompts you." The hand terminal chirped, announcing the new file. Miller accepted it, ran it. It was easy as keying in a door code. Somehow he felt that arming fusion bombs to detonate around him should have been more difficult.
"Got it," he said. "We're good to go. I mean, I still have to move this bastard, but other than that... How fast am I accelerating on this thing, anyway?"
"Eventually it will be faster than the Rossi can go. 4G and ramping up with no sign of easing off the throttle."
"Can't feel it at all," he said.
"I'm sorry about before," Naomi said.
"It was a bad situation. We did what we had to do. Same as always."
"Same as always," she echoed. They didn't speak for a few seconds.
"Thanks for the trigger," Miller said. "Tell Amos I appreciate it."
He cut the connection before she could answer. Long goodbyes weren't anyone's strong suit. The bomb rested in the handcart, magnetic clamps in place and a wide woven steel belt around the whole mass. He moved slowly across the metallic surface of the port docks. If the cart lost its grip on Eros, he wouldn't be strong enough to hold it back. Of course, if one of the increasingly frequent strikes hit him, it would be a lot like getting shot, so waiting around wasn't a good solve either. He put both dangers out of his mind and did the work. For 10 nervous minutes, his suit smelled of overheating plastic. All the diagnostics showed within the error bars, and by the time the recyclers cleared it, his air supply still looked good. Another little mystery he wasn't going to solve. The abyss above him shone with unflickering stars. One of the dots of light was Earth. He didn't know which one. The service hatch had been tucked in a natural outcropping of stone, the raw ferrous cart track like a ribbon of silver in the darkness. Grunting, Miller hauled the cart and the bomb and his own exhausted body up around the curve, and spin gravity once again pressed down on his feet instead of stretching his knees and spine. Lightheaded, he keyed in the codes until the hatch opened. Eros lay before him, darker than the empty sky. He ran the hand terminal connection through the suit, calling Holden for what he expected was the last time. "Miller," Holden said almost immediately.
"I'm heading in now," he said.
"Wait, look, there's a way we might be able to get an automated cart. If the Rossi..."
"Yeah, but you know how it is. I'm already here, and we don't know how fast this son of a bitch can go. We've got a problem we need to fix. This is how we do it."
Holden's hope had been weak anyway. Pro forma. A gesture, and Miller thought maybe even heartfelt. Trying to save everyone. Right to the last. "I understand," Holden finally said.
"Okay, so once I've broken whatever the hell I find in there..."
"We're working on ways to annihilate the station."
"Good. I'd hate to go through the trouble for nothing."
Is there anything you want me to do? After?"
"Nah," Miller said.
And then Julie was at his side, her hair floating around her like they were underwater. She glowed in more starlight than was actually there.
"Wait. Yes, a couple things. Julie's parents. They run Mao Kukowski Mercantile. They knew the war was going to start before it did. They've got to have links to Protogen. Make sure they don't get away with it. And if you see them, tell them I'm sorry I didn't find her in time."
"Right," Holden said. Miller squatted in the darkness. "Was there anything else? Shouldn't there be more? A message to Havelock, maybe? Or Muss? Or Jiagu and his OPA friends? But then there would have to be something to say."
"Okay," Miller said. "That's it, then. It was good working with you."
"I'm sorry it came down this way," Holden said. It wasn't an apology for what he'd done or said, for what he'd chosen and refused.
"Yeah," Miller said. "But what can you do, right?"
It was as close to goodbye as either of them could get. Miller shut the connection, brought up the script Naomi had sent him, and enabled it. While he was at it, he turned the Eros feed back on. A soft, hushing sound, like fingernails scratching down an endless sheet of paper. He turned on the cart's lights, the dark entrance of Eros brightening to industrial gray, shadows scattering to the corners. His imagined Julie stood in the glare like it was a spotlight, the glow illuminating her and the structures behind her at the same time. The remnant of a long dream. Almost over. He took off the brakes, pushed, and went inside Eros. For the last time. Chapter 51. Holden. Holden knew that humans could tolerate extremely high G forces over short durations. With proper safety systems, professional daredevils had sustained impacts in excess of 25 Gs and survived. The human body deformed naturally, absorbed energy and soft tissues and diffused impacts across larger areas. He also knew that the problem with extended exposure to high G was that the constant pressure on the circulatory system would begin exposing weaknesses. Have a weak spot in an artery that could turn into an aneurysm in 40 years? A few hours at 7G might just pop it open now. Capillaries in the eyes started to leak. The eye itself deformed, sometimes causing permanent damage. And then there were the hollow spaces, like the lungs and digestive tract. You piled on enough gravity, and they collapsed. And while combat ships might maneuver at very high G for short durations, every moment spent under thrust multiplied the danger. Eros didn't need to shoot anything at them. It could just keep speeding up until their bodies exploded under the pressure. His console was showing 5G, but even as he watched, it shifted to 6. They couldn't keep this up. Eros was going to get away. There was nothing he could do about it. But he still didn't order Alex to stop accelerating. As if Naomi were reading his mind, "We can't keep this up," popped up on his console, her user ID in front of the text. "Fred's working on it. They might need us to be within range of Eros when they come up with a plan," he replied. Even moving his fingers the millimeters necessary to use the controls built into his chair for exactly this reason was painfully difficult. "Within range for what?" Naomi typed. Holden didn't answer. He had no idea. His blood was burning with drugs to keep him awake and alert even while his body was being crushed. The drugs had the contradictory effect of making his brain run at double speed while not allowing him to actually think. But Fred would come up with something. Lots of smart people were thinking about it. And Miller. Miller was lugging a fusion bomb through Eros right now. When your enemy had the tech advantage, you came at him as low-tech as you could get. Maybe one sad detective pulling a nuclear weapon on a wagon would slip through their defenses. Naomi had said they weren't magic. Maybe Miller could make it, and give them the opening they needed. Either way, Holden had to be there, even if it was just to see. "Fred," Naomi typed to him. Holden opened the connection. Fred looked to him like a man suppressing a grin. "Holden," he said, "how are you guys holding up?"
"6 G's, spit it out."
"Right. So it turns out that the UN cops have been ripping Protogen's network apart, looking for clues as to what the hell's been going on. Guess who showed up as public enemy number one for the Protogen bigwigs? Yours truly. Suddenly all is forgiven and Earth welcomes me back into her warm embrace. The enemy of my enemy thinks I'm a righteous bastard. Goody. My spleen is collapsing. Hurry up," Holden typed. "The idea of Eros crashing into Earth is bad enough. Extinction-level event, even if it's just a rock. But the UN people have been watching the Eros feeds, and it's scaring the shit out of them."
"And?"
"Earth is preparing to launch her entire ground-based nuclear arsenal. Thousands of nukes. They're going to vaporize that rock. The Navy will intercept what's left after the initial attack and sterilize that entire area of space with constant nuclear bombardment. I know it's a risk, but it's what we have."
Holden resisted the urge to shake his head. He didn't want to wind up with one cheek stuck to the chair permanently.
"Eros dodged the Nauvoo. It's going 6 G's right now, and according to Naomi, Miller feels no acceleration. Whatever it's doing, it doesn't have the same inertial limitations we have. What's to stop it from just dodging again? At these speeds, the missiles will never be able to turn around and catch it. And what the hell are you targeting on? Eros doesn't reflect radar anymore."
"That's where you come in. We need you to try bouncing a laser off of it. We can use the Rosinante's targeting system to guide the missiles in. I hate to break it to you, but we'll be out of this game long before those missiles show. We can't keep up. We can't guide the missiles in for you. And once we lose visual,
No one will be able to track where Eros is.
You might have to put it on autopilot, Fred said, meaning, you might all have to die in the seats you're in right now.
I've always wanted to die a martyr and all, but what makes you think that Rosie can beat this thing on its own? I'm not killing my crew because you can't come up with a good plan.
Fred leaned toward the screen, his eyes narrowing. For the first time, Fred's mask slipped, and Holden saw the fear and helplessness behind it.
Look, I know what I'm asking, but you know the stakes. This is what we have. I didn't call you to hear how it won't work. Either help or give up. Right now, Devil's Advocate is just another name for asshole.
I'm crushing myself to death, probably doing permanent damage just because I wouldn't give up, you bastard.
So sorry I didn't sign my crew up to die the minute you said to do it, Holden thought.
Having to type everything out had the advantage of restraining emotional outbursts. Instead of ripping into Fred for questioning his commitment, Holden just typed, "Let me think about it," and cut the connection. The optical tracking system watching Eros flashed a warning to him that the asteroid was increasing speed again. The giant sitting on his chest added a few pounds as Alex pushed the Rosinante to keep up. A flashing red indicator informed Holden that because of the duration they'd spent at the current acceleration, he could expect as much as 12% of the crew to stroke out. It would go up. Enough time, and it would reach 100%. He tried to remember the Rosie's maximum theoretical acceleration. Alex had already flown it at 12G briefly when they'd left the Doniger. The actual limit was one of those trivial numbers, a way to brag about something your ship would never really do. 15G, was it? 20? Miller hadn't felt any acceleration at all. How fast could you go if you didn't even feel it? Almost without realizing he was going to do it, Holden activated the master engine cutoff switch. Within seconds, he was in freefall, racked with coughs as his organs tried to find their original resting places inside his body. When Holden had recovered enough to take one really deep breath, his first in hours, Alex came on the comm.
"Cap, did you kill the engines?" the pilot said.
"Yeah, that was me. We're done. Eros is getting away no matter what we do. We were just prolonging the inevitable and risking some crew deaths in the process."
Naomi turned her chair and gave him a sad little smile. She was sporting a black eye from the acceleration.
"We did our best," she said.
Holden shoved out of his chair hard enough that he bruised his forearms on the ceiling, then shoved off hard again and pinned his back to a bulkhead by grabbing onto a fire extinguisher mount. Naomi was watching him from across the deck, her mouth a comical O of surprise. He knew he probably looked ridiculous, like a petulant child throwing a tantrum, but he couldn't stop himself. He broke free of his grip on the fire extinguisher and floated into the middle of the deck. He hadn't known he'd been pounding on the bulkhead with his other fist. Now that he did, his hand hurt.
"God damn it," he said. "Just God damn it."
"We—" Naomi started, but he cut her off.
"We did our best. What the hell does that matter?"
Holden felt a red haze in his mind, and not all of it was from the drugs.
"I did my best to help the Canterbury, too. I tried to do the right thing when I let us be taken by the Doniger. Did my good intentions mean jack shit?"
Naomi's expression went flat. Now her eyelids dropped, and she stared at him from narrow slits, her lips pressed together until they were almost white.
"They wanted me to kill you," Holden thought. "They wanted me to kill my crew just in case Eros can't break 15G, and I couldn't do it."
The guilt and rage and sorrow played against each other, turning into something thin and unfamiliar. He couldn't put a name to the feeling.
"You're the last person I'd expect to hear self-pity from," she said, her voice tight. "Where's the captain who's always asking, 'What can we do right now to make things better?'"
Holden gestured around himself helplessly.
Show me which button to push to stop everyone on Earth from being killed, I'll push it. Just as long as it doesn't kill you, he thought. Naomi unbuckled her harness and floated toward the crew ladder. I'm going below to check on Amos, she said, then opened the deck hatch. She paused. I'm your operations officer, Holden. Monitoring communication lines is part of the job. I know what Fred wanted. Holden blinked, and Naomi pulled herself out of sight. The hatch slammed behind her with a bang that couldn't have been any harder than normal, but felt like it was anyway. Holden called up to the cockpit and told Alex to take a break and get some coffee. The pilot stopped on his way through the deck, looking like he wanted to talk, but Holden just waved him on. Alex shrugged and left. The watery feeling in his gut had taken root and bloomed into a full-fledged, limb-shaking panic. Some vicious, vindictive, self-flagellating part of his mind insisted on running non-stop movies of Eros hurtling toward Earth. It would come screaming down out of the sky, like every religion's vision of apocalypse made real. Fire and earthquakes and pestilential rain sweeping the land. But each time Eros hit the Earth in his mind, it was the explosion of the Canterbury he saw. A shockingly sudden white light, and then nothing but the sound of ice pebbles rattling across his hull like gentle hail. Mars would survive, for a while. Pockets of the belt would hold out even longer, probably. They had a culture of making do, surviving on scraps, living on the bleeding edge of their resources. But in the end, without Earth, everything would eventually die. Humans had been out of the gravity well a long time, long enough to have developed the technology to cut that umbilical cord, but they just never bothered to do it. Stagnant. Humanity, for all its desire to fling itself into every livable pocket it could reach, had become stagnant. Satisfied to fly around in ships built half a century before, using technology that hadn't changed in longer than that. Earth had been so focused on her own problems that she'd ignored her far-flung children, except when asking for her share of their labors. Mars had bent her entire population to the task of remaking the planet, changing its red face to green, trying to make a new Earth to end their reliance on the old. And the belt had become the slums of the solar system, everyone too busy trying to survive to spend any time creating something new. We found the protomolecule at exactly the right time for it to do the most damage to us, Holden thought. It had looked like a shortcut, a way to avoid having to do any of the work, to just jump straight to godhood. And it had been so long since anything was a real threat to humanity outside of itself that no one was even smart enough to be scared. Dresden had said it himself. The things that had made the protomolecule, loaded it into Phoebe and shot it at the Earth, were already godlike back when humanity's ancestors thought photosynthesis and the flagellum were cutting edge. But he'd taken their ancient engine of destruction and turned the key anyway. Because when you got right down to it, humans were still just curious monkeys. They still had to poke everything they found with a stick to see what it did. The red haze in Holden's vision had taken on a strange strobing pattern. It took him a moment to realize that a red telltale on his panel was flashing, letting him know that the Ravi was calling. He kicked off a nearby crash couch, floated back to his station, and opened the link. Rosinante here, Ravi, go ahead. Holden, why are we stopped? McBride asked. Because we weren't going to keep up anyway, and the danger of crew casualties was getting too high, he replied. It sounded weak, even to him. Cowardly. McBride didn't seem to notice. Roger, I'm going to get new orders. We'll let you know if anything changes. Holden killed the connection and stared blankly at the console. The visual tracking system was doing its very best to keep Eros in sight. The Rossi was a good ship, state-of-the-art, and since Alex had tagged the asteroid as a threat, the computer would do everything in its power to keep track of it. But Eros was a fast-moving, low-albedo object that didn't reflect radar. It could move unpredictably, and at high speed. It was just a matter of time before they lost track of it, especially if it wanted to be lost track of. Next to the tracking information on his console, a small data window opened to inform him that the Ravi had turned on its transponder. It was standard practice, even for military ships, to keep them on, when there was no apparent threat or need for stealth. The radio man on the little UNN Corvette must have flipped it back on out of habit. And now the Rossi registered as a known vessel, and threw it onto the threat display with a gently pulsing green dot and a name tag. Holden looked at it blankly for a long moment. He felt his eyes go wide. "Shit," Holden said, then opened the shipwide comm. "Naomi, I need you in ops." "I think I'd rather stay down here for a bit," she replied. Holden hit the battle station's alert button on his console. The deck light shifted to red and a klaxon sounded three times. "Exo Nagata to ops," he said. Let her chew him out later. He'd have it coming. But right now, he didn't have any time to waste. Naomi was on the ops deck in less than a minute. Holden had already buckled back into his crash couch and was pulling up the comm logs. Naomi pushed over to a chair and belted in as well. She gave him an inquiring look. "Are we going to die after all?" But said nothing. If he said so, she would. He felt a spike of equal parts admiration for and impatience with her. He found what he was looking for in the logs before speaking. "Okay," he said. "We've had radio contact with Miller after Eros dropped off of radar, is that right?" "Yes, that's right," she said. "But his suit isn't powerful enough to transmit through the shell of Eros out to much distance, so one of the moored ships is boosting the signal for him. Which means that whatever Eros is doing to kill the radar isn't killing all radio transmissions from outside." "That seems right," Naomi said, a growing curiosity in her voice. "And you still have the control codes for the 5 OPA freighters on the surface, right?" "Yes, sir." And then a moment later, "Oh, shit." "Okay," Holden said, turning in his chair to face Naomi with a grin. "Why do the Rossi and every other naval ship in the system have a switch to turn off their transponders? So the enemy can't get a missile lock on the transponder signal and blow them up," she said, sharing his grin now. Holden spun his chair back around and began opening a comm channel to Tycho Station. "XO, would you be so kind as to use the control codes Miller gave you to turn those 5 OPA freighters back on and fire up their transponders? Unless our visitor on Eros can outrun radio waves, I think we've gotten around the acceleration problem." "Aye, aye, Captain," Naomi replied. Even looking the other way, Holden could hear the smile in her voice, and it melted the last of the ice in his gut. They had a plan. They were going to make a difference. "Call coming in from the Ravi," Naomi said. "You want it before I turn the transponders on?" "Hell yes." The line clicked. "Captain Holden, we've got our new orders. Seems we're going to be chasing that thing a little further." McBride sounded almost like someone who hadn't just been sent to her death. Stoic. "You might want to hold off on that for a couple minutes," Holden said. "We have an alternative." As Naomi activated the transponders on the 5 OPA freighters Miller had left moored to the surface of Eros, Holden laid out the plan to McBride and then, on a separate line, Fred. By the time Fred had gotten back to him with an enthusiastic approval of the plan, from both him and the UN Naval Command, the 5 freighters were pinging away, telling the solar system where they were. An hour after that, the largest swarm of interplanetary nuclear weapons in the history of humanity had been fired and were winging their way toward Eros. "We're going to win," Holden thought as he watched the missiles take flight like a swarm of angry red dots on his threat display. "We're going to beat this thing." And what was more, his crew was going to see the end of it. No one else had to die. Except... "Miller's calling," Naomi said. "Probably noticed we turned his ships back on." Holden had a wrenching feeling in his stomach. Miller would be there, on Eros, when those missiles arrived. Not everyone would get to celebrate the coming victory.
"Hey, Miller, how you doing?" he said, not quite able to keep the funereal tone out of his voice.
Miller's voice was choppy and half-drowned by static, but not so garbled that Holden couldn't hear the tone in it and know that he was about to take a piss all over their parade.
"Holden," Miller said, "we have a problem."
Chapter 52. Miller. 1, 2, 3. Miller pushed down on the hand terminal, resetting the trigger again. The double doors in front of him had once been one of thousands of quietly automated mechanisms. They had run reliably in their subtle magnetic tracks, maybe for years. Now, something black with a texture of tree bark grew like creepers around their sides, deforming the metal. Past them lay the port corridors, the warehouses, the casino. Everything that had been Eros Station, and was now the vanguard of an invading alien intelligence. But to reach it, Miller had to pry open a stuck door, in less than 5 seconds, while wearing an environment suit. He put the hand terminal down again and reached quickly for the thin crack where the two doors met. 1, 2. The door shifted a centimeter, flakes of black matter sifting down. 3, 4. He grabbed the hand terminal again, resetting the trigger. This shit just wasn't going to work. Miller sat on the ground beside the cart. The Eros feed whispered and muttered, apparently unaware of the tiny invaders scratching at the station's skin. Miller took a long, deep breath. Door didn't move. He had to get past it. Naomi wasn't going to like this. With his one free hand, Miller loosened the woven metal strap around the bomb until it could rock back and forth a little. Carefully, slowly, he lifted the corner of it. Then, watching the status readouts, he wedged the hand terminal under it, the metal corner digging hard into the touchscreen over the enter button. The trigger stayed green. If the station shook or shifted, he'd still have 5 seconds to get to it. Good enough. Braced with both hands, Miller tugged at the doors. More of the black crust fell away as he levered the doors open far enough to see through. The corridor beyond was nearly round. The dark growth had filled in the corners until the passage looked like a huge, desiccated blood vessel. The only lights were his suit's headlights, and a million tiny luminescent dots that swirled in the air like blue fireflies. When the Eros feed pulsed, growing momentarily louder, the fireflies dimmed and then returned. The environment suit reported breathable air with higher-than-expected concentrations of argon, ozone, and benzene. One of the luminescent dots floated past him, swirling on currents he couldn't feel. Miller ignored it, pushing at the doors, widening the gap centimeter by centimeter. He could put in an arm to feel the crust. It seemed solid enough to support the cart. That was a godsend. If it had been thigh-high alien mud, he would have had to find some other way to carry the bomb. It was going to be bad enough hauling the cart up to the rounded surface. "No rest for the wicked," Julie Mao said in his mind. "No peace for the good." He went back to work. By the time he'd shoved the doors wide enough to get through, he was sweating. His arms and back ached. The dark crust had started growing down the corridor, tendrils shooting out toward the airlock, keeping to the edges, where walls met floor or ceiling. The blue glow had colonized the air. Eros was heading out the corridor as quickly as he was heading in. Faster, maybe. Miller hauled the cart up with both hands, watching the hand terminal closely. The bomb rocked, but not so much it lost its grip on the trigger. Once he was safely in the corridor, he took the terminal back. 1. 2. The heavy bomb casing had carved a little divot in the touchpad, but it still worked. Miller took the cart handle and leaned forward. The uneven, organic surface beneath him translated into the rough tug and flutter of the cart's vibration. He'd died here once. He'd been poisoned. Shot. These halls, or ones much like them, had been his battleground. His and Holden's. They were unrecognizable now. He passed through a wide, nearly empty space. The crust had thinned here, the metal walls of the warehouse showing through in places. One LED still glowed in the ceiling, the cool, white light spilling onto the darkness. The path led him to the casino level, the architecture of commerce still bringing visitors to the same spot. The alien bark was nearly gone, but the space had been transformed. Pachinko machines stood in their rows, half-melted or exploded, or, like a few, still glittering and asking for the financial information that would unlock the gaudy lights and festive celebratory sound effects. The card tables were still visible under mushroom caps of clear, glutinous gel. Lining the walls and cathedral-high ceilings, black ribs rippled with hair-like threads that glowed at the tips without offering any illumination. Something screamed, the sound muffled by Miller's suit. The broadcast feed of the station sounded louder and richer now that he was under its skin. He had the sudden, transporting memory of being a child and watching a video feed of a boy who'd been swallowed by a monstrous whale. Something gray and the size of Miller's two fists together flew by almost too fast to see. It hadn't been a bird. Something scuttled behind an overturned vending machine. He realized what was missing. There had been 1.5 million people on Eros, and a large percentage of them had been here, on the casino level, when their own personal apocalypse came. But there were no bodies. Or no, that wasn't true. The black crust, the millions of dark rills above him with their soft oceanic glow, those were the corpses of Eros, recreated. Human flesh, remade. A suit alarm told him he was starting to hyperventilate. Darkness started to creep in at the edge of his vision. Miller sank to his knees. "Don't pass out, you son of a bitch," he told himself. "Don't pass out, or if you do, at least land so your weight's on the damn trigger." Julie put her hand on his. He could almost feel it, and it steadied him. She was right. They were only bodies. Just dead people. Victims. Just another slab of recycled meat, same as every unlicensed whore he'd seen stabbed to death in the cheap hotels on Ceres. Same as all the suicides who'd thrown themselves out of airlocks. Okay, the protomolecule had mutilated the flesh in weird ways. Didn't change what it was. Didn't change what he was. "When you're a cop," he told Julie, repeating something he'd told every rookie he'd been partnered with in his career, "you don't have the luxury of feeling things. You have to do the job." "So do the job," she said gently. He nodded. He stood. "Do the job." As if in response, the sound in his suit changed. The Eros feed fluting up through 100 different frequencies before exploding in a harsh flood of what he thought was Hindi. Human voices. "Till human voices wake us," he thought, without quite being able to recall where the phrase came from. Somewhere in the station, there was going to be something. A control mechanism, or a power supply, or whatever the protomolecule was using instead of an engine. He didn't know what it would look like, or how it would be defended. He didn't have any idea how it worked, apart from the assumption that if he blew it up, it wouldn't keep going very well. "So we go back," he told Julie. "We go back to what we do know." The thing that was growing inside Eros, using the stone skin of the asteroid as its own unarticulated exoskeleton, hadn't cut off the ports. It hadn't moved the interior walls or recreated the chambers and passages of the casino level. So the station's layout should be pretty near what it had always been. Okay. Whatever it used to drive the station through space, it was using a shitload of energy. Okay. So, find the hotspot. With his free hand, he checked the environment suit. Ambient temperature was 27 degrees. Hot, but far from unbearable. He walked briskly back toward the port corridor. The temperature dropped by less than 0.1 degrees, but it did drop. All right, then. He could go to each of the corridors, find which one was hottest, and follow it. When he found a place in the station that was, say, 3 or 4 degrees hotter than the rest, that would be the place. He'd roll the cart up beside it, let up his thumb, and count to 5. No problem. When he got back to the cart, something golden with the soft look of heather was growing around the wheels. Miller scraped it off as best he could, but one of the wheels had still developed a squeak. Nothing to be done about that. With one hand hauling the cart and the other mashing down on his hand terminal's dead man switch, Miller headed up, deeper into the station. "She's mine," mindless Eero said. It had been stuck on the phrase for the better part of an hour. "She's mine. She's mine."
"Fine," Miller muttered. "You can have her."
His shoulder ached. The squeak in the cart's wheel had grown worse, the whine of it cutting through the souls of the damned madness of the Eero's feed. His thumb was starting to tingle from the constant, relentless pressure of not annihilating himself quite yet. With each level he rose, the spin gravity grew lighter, and the Coriolis a little more noticeable. It wasn't quite the same as on Ceres, but it was close, and felt like coming home. He found himself looking forward to when the job was done. He imagined himself back in his hole, a six-pack of beer, some music on the speakers that had an actual composer instead of the wild, empty-minded glossolalia of the dead station. Maybe some light jazz. Whoever thought the idea of light jazz would be appealing? "Catch me if you can, cocksuckers," Eero said. "I am gone and gone and gone, gone and gone and gone." The inner levels of the station were both familiar and stranger. Away from the mass grave of the casino level, more of Eros's old life showed through. Tube stops still glowed, announcing line errors and counseling patients. Air recyclers hummed. The floors were relatively clean and clear. The sense of near-normalcy made the changes stand out eerily. Dark fronds coated the walls with swirling nautilus patterns. Flakes of the stuff drifted down from above, whirling in the spin gravity like soot. Eero still had spin gravity, but didn't have gravity from the massive acceleration it was under. Miller chose not to try to figure that out. A flock of softball-sized spider-like things crawled through the corridor, leaving a slick sheen of glowing slime behind them. It wasn't until he paused to knock one off the cart that he recognized them as severed hands, the trailing wrist bones charred black and remade. Part of his mind was screaming, but it was a distant one, and easy to ignore. He had to respect the protomolecule. For something that had been expecting prokaryotic anaerobes, it was doing a bang-up job of making do. He paused to check his suit sensor array. The temperature had risen 0.5 degree since he'd left the casino, and 0.1 degree since he'd entered this particular main hall. The background radiation was also climbing, his poor, abused flesh sucking in more rads. The concentration of benzene was going down, and his suit was picking up more exotic, aromatic molecules. Tetracene, anthracene, naphthalene, with behavior sufficiently strange to confuse the sensors. So it was the right direction. He leaned forward, the cart resisting his pull like a bored kid. As he recalled, the structural layout was roughly like Ceres's. and he knew Ceres like he knew his name. One more level up, maybe two, there would be a confluence of services from the lower high G levels and the supply and energy systems that did better at lower gravity. It seemed as likely a place to grow a command and control center as any, as good a location for a brain. "Gone and gone and gone," Eros said, "and gone." It was funny, he thought, how the ruins of the past shaped everything that came after. It seemed to work on all levels, one of the truths of the universe. Back in the ancient days, when humanity still lived entirely down a well, the paths laid down by Roman legions had become asphalt, and later ferro-concrete, without ever changing a curve or a turn. On Ceres, Eros, Tycho, the bore of the standard corridor had been determined by mining tools built to accommodate the trucks and lifts of Earth, which had in turn been designed to go down tracks wide enough for a mule cart's axle. And now the alien, the thing from out in the vast dark, was growing along the corridors, ducts, tube routes, and water pipes laid out by a handful of ambitious primates. He wondered what it would have been like if the protomolecule hadn't been captured by Saturn, had actually found its way into the soup of primordial Earth. No fusion reactors, no navigation drives, no complex flesh to appropriate. What would it have done differently if it hadn't had to build around some other evolution's design choices? "Miller," Julie said, "keep moving." He blinked. He was standing in the empty passageway at the base of an access ramp. He didn't know how long he'd been lost in his own mind. Years, maybe. He blew out a long breath and started up the ramp. The corridors above him were reading as considerably hotter than ambient, almost 3 degrees. He was getting close. There was no light, though. He took his tingling, half-numb thumb off the select button, turned on the hand terminal's little utility LED, and got back to the dead man switch just before the count of 4. Gone and gone and. The Eros feed squealed, a chorus of voices chattering in Russian and Hindi, clamoring over the old singular voice and being drowned out in turn by a deep, creaking howl. Whale song, maybe. Miller's suit mentioned politely that he had half an hour of oxygen left. He shut the alarm down. The transfer station was overgrown. Pale fronds swarmed along the corridors and twisted into ropes. Recognizable insects, flies, cockroaches, water spiders, crawled along the thick white cables in purposeful waves. Tendrils of something that looked like articulated bile swept back and forth, leaving a film of scurrying larvae. They were as much victim of the protomolecule as the human population. Poor bastards. "You can't take the razor back," Eros said, and its voice sounded almost triumphant. "You can't take the razor back. She is gone and gone and gone." The temperature was climbing faster now. It took him a few minutes to decide that Spinward might be slightly warmer. He hauled the cart. He could feel the squeaking, a tiny, rattling tremor in the bones of his hand. Between the mass of the bomb and the failing wheel bearings, his shoulders were starting to really ache. Good thing he wasn't going to have to haul this damn thing back down. Julie was waiting for him in the darkness. The thin beam from his hand terminal cut through her. Her hair floated, spin gravity having, after all, no effect on phantoms of the mind. Her expression was grave. "How does it know?" she asked. Miller paused. Every now and then, all through his career, some daydreamed witness would say something, use some phrase, laugh at the wrong thing, and he'd know that the back of his mind had a new angle on the case. This was that moment. "You can't take the razor back," Eros crowed. "The comet that took the protomolecule into the solar system in the first place was a dead drop, not a ship," Julie said, her dark lips never moving. It was just ballistic. Any ice bullet with a protomolecule in deep freeze. It was aimed at Earth, but it missed and got grabbed by Saturn instead. The payload didn't steer it, didn't drive it, didn't navigate.
It didn't need to, Miller said.
It's navigating now. It's going to Earth. How does it know to go to Earth? Where did that information come from? It's talking. Where did that grammar come from? Who is the voice of Eros? Miller closed his eyes. His suit mentioned that he only had 20 minutes of air. You can't take the razor back. She is gone and gone and gone.
Oh, fuck, Miller said. Oh, Jesus.
He let go of the cart, turning back toward the ramp and the light and the wide station corridors. Everything was shaking, the station itself trembling, like someone on the edge of hypothermia. Only, of course, it wasn't. The only one shaking was him. It was all in the voice of Eros. It had been there all the time. He should have known. Maybe he had. The protomolecule didn't know English, or Hindi, or Russian, or any of the languages it had been spouting. All of that had been in the minds and softwares of Eros's dead, coded in the neurons and grammar programs that the protomolecule had eaten. Eaten, but not destroyed. It had kept the information and languages and complex cognitive structures, building itself on them, like asphalt over the roads the legions built. The dead of Eros weren't dead. Juliet Andromeda Mao was alive. He was grinning so hard his cheeks ached. With one gloved hand, he tried the connection. The signal was too weak. He couldn't get through. He told his uplink on the surface ship to crank up the power. Got a connection. Holden's voice came over the link.
Hey, Miller. How you doing?
The words were soft, apologetic. A hospice worker being gentle to the dying. An incandescent spark of annoyance lit his mind, but he kept his voice steady.
Holden, he said. We have a problem.
Chapter 53. Holden.
Actually, we've sort of figured out how to solve the problem, Holden replied.
I don't think so. I'm linking you to my suit's med data, Miller said.
A few seconds later, four columns of numbers popped up in a small window on Holden's console. It all looked fairly normal, though there were subtleties that only a med tech like Shed would be able to interpret correctly.
Okay, Holden said. That's great. You're getting a little irradiated, but other than that...
Miller cut him off.
Am I suffering from hypoxia? He said.
The data from his suit showed 87 millimeters of mercury, comfortably above baseline.
No, Holden said. Anything that would make a guy hallucinate or get demented? Alcohol, opiates, something like that?
Not that I can see, Holden said, growing impatient. What's this about? Are you seeing things?
Just the usual, Miller replied. I wanted to get that shit out the way because I know what you're going to say next.
He stopped talking, and the radio hissed and popped in Holden's ear. When Miller spoke again after several seconds of silence, his voice had taken on a different tone. It wasn't quite pleading, but close enough to make Holden shift uncomfortably in his seat.
She's alive.
There was only one she in Miller's universe. Julie Mao.
Okay, not sure how to respond to that. You'll have to take my word that I'm not having a nervous breakdown or psychotic episode or anything like that. But Julie's in here. She's driving Eros.
Holden looked at the suit's medical data again, but it kept reporting normal readings. All the numbers except for radiation comfortably in the green. His blood chemistry didn't even look like he was particularly stressed for a guy carrying a fusion bomb to his own funeral.
Miller, Julie's dead. We both saw the body. We saw what the protomolecule
did to it. We saw her body, sure. We just assumed she was dead because of the damage.
She didn't have a heartbeat, Holden said. No brain activity, no metabolism. That's pretty much the definition of dead.
How do we know what dead looks like to the protomolecule?
We... Holden started, then stopped.
We don't, I guess. But no heartbeat, that's a pretty good start.
Miller laughed.
We've both seen the feeds, Holden. Those rib cages equipped with one arm that drag themselves around. Think they have a heartbeat? This shit hasn't been playing by our rules since day one. You expect it to start now?
Holden smiled to himself. Miller was right.
Okay, so what makes you think Julie isn't just a rib cage and a mass of tentacles?
She might be, but it's not her body I'm talking about, Miller said.
She's in here. Her mind. It's like she's flying her old racing pinnace, the Razorback. She's been babbling about it on the radio for hours now, and I just didn't put it together. But now that I have, it's pretty goddamn clear.
Why is she headed toward Earth?
I don't know, Miller said.
He sounded excited, interested, more alive than Holden had ever heard him.
Maybe the protomolecule wants to get there and it's messing with her. Julie wasn't the first person to get infected, but she's the first one that survived long enough to get somewhere. Maybe she's the seed crystal, and everything that the protomolecule's doing is built on her.
I don't know that, but I can find out. I just need to find her. Talk to her.
You need to get that bomb to wherever the controls are and set it off.
I can't do that, Miller said. Because, of course, he couldn't.
It doesn't matter, Holden thought. In a little less than 30 hours, you're both radioactive dust.
All right, can you find your girl in less than...
Holden had the Rossi do a revised time of impact for the incoming missiles. 27 hours?
Why? What happens in 27 hours?
Earth fired her entire interplanetary nuclear arsenal at Eros a few hours ago. We just turned the transponders on and the 5 freighters you parked on the surface. The missiles are targeting them. The Rossi is guessing 27 hours to impact based on the current acceleration curve. The Martian and UN navies are on their way to sterilize the area after detonation. Make sure nothing survives or slips the net.
Jesus.
Yeah, Holden said with a sigh. I'm sorry I didn't tell you sooner. I've had a lot going on, and it sort of slipped my mind.
There was another long silence on the line.
You can stop them, Miller said. Shut down the transponders.
Holden spun his chair around to face Naomi. Her face had the same what-did-he-just-say look that he knew was on his own.
She pulled the suit's medical data over to her console, then called up the Rossi's medical expert system and began running a full medical diagnostic. The implication was clear. She thought something was wrong with Miller that wasn't immediately apparent from the data they were getting. If the protomolecule had infected him, used him as a last-ditch misdirection...
Not a chance, Miller. This is our last shot. If we blow this one, Eros can orbit the Earth spraying brown goo all over it. No way we take that risk.
Look, Miller said, his tone alternating between the earlier pleading and a growing frustration. Julie is in here. If I can find her, a way to talk to her, I can stop this without the nukes.
What, ask the protomolecule to pretty please not infect the Earth when that was what it was designed to do? Appeal to its better nature?
Miller paused for a moment before speaking again.
Look, Holden, I think I know what's going on here. This thing was intended to infect single-celled organisms, the most basic forms of life, right?
Holden shrugged, then remembered there was no video feed and said, okay.
That didn't work, but it's a smart bastard, adaptive. It got into a human host, a complex multi-celled organism, aerobic, huge brain. Nothing like what it was built for. It's been improvising ever since. That mess on the stealth ship, that was its first try. We saw what it was doing with Julie in that Eros bathroom.
It was learning how to work with us.
Where are you going with this? Holden said. There was no time pressure yet, with the missiles still more than a day away, but he couldn't quite keep the impatience out of his voice.
All I'm saying is Eros now isn't what the protomolecules designers planned on. It's their original plan, laid over the top of billions of years of our evolution. And when you improvise, you use what you've got. You use what works. Julie's the template. Her brain, her emotions are all over this thing. She sees this run to Earth as a race, and she's crowing about winning, laughing at you because you can't keep up.
Wait, Holden said.
She's not attacking Earth. She's going home. For all we know, she's not heading for Earth at all. Luna, maybe. She grew up there. The protomolecule piggybacked on her structure, her brain. And so she infected it as much as it infected her. If I can make her understand what's really going on, then maybe I can negotiate with her.
How do you know that?
Call it a hunch, Miller said. I'm good with hunches.
Holden whistled, the entire situation doing a flip-flop in his head. The new perspective was dizzying.
But the protomolecule still wants to obey its program, Holden said, and we have no idea what that is.
I can damn sure tell you it isn't wiping humans out. The things that shot Phoebe at us 2 billion years ago didn't know what the hell humans were. Whatever it wants to do needed biomass, and it's got that now.
Holden couldn't stop himself from snorting at that.
So what? They don't mean us any harm? Seriously? You think if we explain that we'd rather not have it land on Earth, then it will just agree and go somewhere else?
Not it, Miller said. Her.
Naomi looked up at Holden, shaking her head. She wasn't seeing anything organic wrong with Miller either.
I've been working this case for, shit, almost a year, Miller said. I've climbed into her life, read her mail, met her friends. I know her. She's about as independent as a person can be, and she loves us.
Us? Holden asked.
People. She loves humans. She gave up being the little rich girl and joined the OPA. She backed the belt because it was the right thing to do. No way she kills us if she knows that's what's happening. I just need to find a way to explain. I can do this. Give me a chance.
Holden ran a hand through his hair, grimacing at the accumulating grease. A day or two at high G was not conducive to regular showering.
Can't do it, Holden said. Stakes are too high. We're going ahead with the plan, I'm sorry.
She'll beat you, Miller said.
What?
Okay, maybe she won't. You've got a shitload of firepower. But the protomolecules figured out how to get around inertia. And Julie? She's a fighter, Holden. If you take her on, my money's on her.
Holden had seen the video of Julie fighting off her attackers on board the stealth ship. She'd been methodical and ruthless in her own defense. She'd fought without giving quarter. He'd seen the wildness in her eyes when she felt trapped and threatened. Only her attacker's combat armor had kept her from doing a lot more damage before they took her down. Holden felt the hair on the back of his neck stand up at the idea of Eros actually fighting. So far, it had been content to run from their clumsy attacks. What happened when it went to war?
You could find her, Holden said, and use the bomb.
If I can't get through to her, Miller said, that's my deal. I'll find her. I'll talk to her. If I can't get through, I'll take her out and you can turn Eros into a cinder. I'm fine with that. But you have to give me time to try it my way first.
Holden looked at Naomi, looking back at him. Her face was pale. He wanted to see the answer in her expression, to know what he should do based on what she thought. He didn't. It was his call.
Do you need more than 27 hours? Holden finally asked.
He heard Miller exhale loudly. There was gratitude in his voice that was, in its own way, worse than the pleading had been.
I don't know.
There are a couple of thousand kilometers of tunnels down here, and none of the transit systems work. I have to walk everywhere pulling this damn wagon. Not to mention the fact that I don't really know what I'm even looking for. But give me a little time. I'll figure it. And you know that if this doesn't work, you'll have to kill her. Yourself and Julie? I know. Holden had the Rosie calculate how long it would take Eros to reach the Earth at the current rate of acceleration. The missiles from Earth were covering the distance a lot faster than Eros was. The IPBMs were just overpowered Epstein drives with nuclear bombs.